Welcome to the Raging Rhino Podcast. This is podcast number 74. My name is John. I wonder what it's like to be a superhero. I wonder where I'd go if I could fly around downtown. From some other planet, I get this funky high on a yellow sun. Boy, I bet my friends will all be stunned. It was 37 years ago in a grocery store on the west side of San Antonio, Texas. I was a 7-year-old boy who loved to wake up every Saturday morning to watch Super Friends. And I had just wandered into the magazine aisle. Down on the bottom shelf, right where a boy my age would be looking, sat a few comic books. One in particular caught my eye because it was one of those characters I liked from the Super Friends. Across the top in red letters was The Flash. And below that was The Flash himself dancing with Batgirl. Other costume characters danced in the background, including Captain Cold, but he was a bad guy. In the foreground was a guy in a gas mask shooting Bizarro. The word balloons had Flash and Batgirl talking about being at a masquerade party. Okay, that explained the odd mixture of the heroes and the villains. But in the corner, a mysterious hand held an invitation that foretold a death in the issue. It was only 40 cents. So I asked my mom if she would buy it for me. And she did. And so, I came home with my very first comic book, Flash number 275. It was the middle of a story arc, so I had to kind of guess what had happened before. Batgirl on the cover turned out to be Flash's wife. They were supposed to go to the masquerade party as Batman and Batgirl, but the costume shop messed up, so Flash ended up going in his own costume. That's kind of funny. But there was a death, as promised. Near the end of the issue, Flash finds a large, seemingly deranged man standing over the dead body of his wife, Iris. I was amazed. This character that I only knew as a kid's cartoon was in a story clearly meant for somebody a little bit older. He had a wife who was never mentioned in the cartoon, and she dies, which never happened in a cartoon back then. He apparently had an obsessed teenage fan using her mind control powers to find out Flash's secret identity and causing his wife to think he was having an affair. It was kind of cool to be reading about what I considered to be adult stuff. My favorite part of the issue was when Green Lantern made a brief cameo. See, Flash was my second favorite character from the Super Friends. Green Lantern was my favorite. And here they were together in Flash's comic book. A couple of issues later, Flash would visit his superhero friends in the Justice League on a satellite. There he was with Green Lantern, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman. It wasn't long after I would find Green Lantern in his own comic book and the Justice League team book, and nothing would ever be the same for me again. I tell you that story so you understand how far back I go with DC Comics, so you know how important these characters are to my inner child. But there's another reason. I was introduced to DC Comics a few years before 1985. Comic book fans would understand why that year is significant. When I started reading, I had to become acquainted with a concept that only recently started to come back into the comic books and on DC's television shows, specifically, and not too ironically, The Flash. I had to learn about the multiverse. The multiverse is actually based on quantum theory that, you know what, I'm not going to try to explain that. Just look it up. The basic premise is there are multiple realities. There's one reality where Superman first appeared in the 1930s, one where he grew up in Soviet Russia, one where Batman lived in the Victorian era and fought Jack the Ripper, one where Wonder Woman and the Amazons are at war with Aquaman and Atlantis. Just about anything you can imagine. So, when I go to watch a superhero movie, especially a DC movie because I'm so passionate about them, I go in with the mindset that this is not the comic book version of my hero, but another reality in the multiverse. So, you can change characters around to fit a movie. Sometimes those changes are just little tweaks, sometimes they're quite a bit different from the comic books. The more drastic departures from the comic book can work, like the Joker in The Dark Knight, while others are shit, like Parallax in the Green Lantern movie. I think that's the problem most comic book movie viewers have, and what some may have going in to see Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice. They go in with their bias about the characters based on what they've read and expect the pages to come to life. And when it doesn't happen, they get all pissy about it. This is not Superman from Grant Morrison's All-Star Superman comic book series. This is not the Superman from the Smallville television show. This is not the Christopher Reeve Superman, the first Superman movie where Superman killed Zod. What, you think Zod survived becoming human and falling into a crevice in the sub-zero Arctic? I'm not looking to compare this Superman to Christopher Reeve or Brandon Routh, nor do I want to try to compare this Batman to Michael Keaton or Christian Bale. If I were to do that, I would be coming into the movie with the wrong mindset, and I'd probably hate it before it starts. I'm watching this movie for what it is in its own universe, its own continuity. And I am biased. I admit it. But I love this movie. I have seen the movie 4 times as of this recording. The very first available showing at 6 p.m. on March 24th, the second weekend in IMAX, and twice more in the regular theaters. I'm not a big fan of 3D, so I won't be seeing it in that format, but there's a decent possibility I'll see it at least once more in the theaters. The rest of this podcast is going to talk about the movie, with a little politics near the end. It's been out for a month, so I'm assuming you've watched it by now. And if not, and you don't want key plot points, endings, and quotes to be spoiled, go out and watch the movie, then come back and listen. You have been warned. Originally, I planned going through the movie scene by scene. That would have taken forever. So I think I'd rather just touch on the different characters. This is a Superman who, as I've mentioned in the previous podcast, is still growing to become that iconic hero. But he's not there yet. He's still relatively inexperienced and more than a touch naive. He spent the year and a half since the end of the previous movie pretty much just saving whoever he can from peril. He has not endured a test anywhere near as severe as the attack of the Phantom Zone villains. He's still struggling with his place in the world. And I kind of like that. A Superman who is supremely confident and experienced and always doing the right thing to make everyone in the world happy is pretty fucking boring. I like the fact that no matter how much good he tries to do, he has detractors, because no matter what you do or how you live your life, someone is always going to hate you for it. He loves Lois, and doesn't care about what the rest of the world thinks when he goes to save her. Lois is his world, just like Gina is my world. And that makes me feel like I have a little superhero in me. Of course, Gina is infatuated with Henry Cavill, so I'm sure she wouldn't mind having a little Superman in her in a different kind of meaning. But my favorite scene with him is a quiet moment in the midst of a raging battle, showing the heart of the character. His final words to Lois before he dies killing Doomsday. What? I told you there were spoilers. Lois is... Well, I can sum up how great Lois Lane is when at the beginning of the movie, the general is surprised the interviewer would be a lady. And Lois replies, "I'm not a lady, I'm a journalist." She's smart, she's tenacious. The fact that she's a woman is immaterial. She fights her own battle for the truth during the first part of the movie as boldly as the Trinity battles Doomsday at the end of the movie. For me, her best scene was the bathroom confrontation with Secretary Swanwick. I know, you thought I was going to say the bathtub scene. Let me just say, Amy Adams is a beautiful woman. And leave it at that. If, like me, you really like the scene in The Dark Knight where Batman takes out Joker's henchmen in the high-rise, then you will love the Dawn of Justice scene in the warehouse where Batman fights to save Martha Kent. It is the best cinematic Batman fight scene yet. And I linked to The Dark Knight on purpose because when both Ledger and Affleck were announced for the roles of Joker and Batman in their respective movies, I was surprised and initially against it, but I caught myself. I stopped and I decided I'm going to give them the benefit of a doubt. And I'm glad I did. Affleck was a little excessively broody, but I know it had to be that way for the story. Batman had to have a deep fear and anger and distrust for Superman, and that had to permeate his character until the battle. My favorite scene, though, was actually the impromptu interview with Clark Kent, where you see the break in Bruce Wayne's playboy facade. He looks at Clark and almost growls, "Don't believe everything you read, son." And then he gives a frank rebuttal to the accusations that Gotham City thinks vigilantes are above the law. Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman? Fantastic. Her strength, her confidence, everything about her was spot on for what I personally would want in a cinematic introduction to Wonder Woman. Her theme music is excellent. Seriously, go find it and download it. Now, right now. If you're not ready to cheer when she shows up in costume and the drumbeat of her theme music is playing, then you can't call yourself a comic book fan. Yeah, that's where I'm going to draw the line. That point right there, that's where you can't call yourself a comic book fan. My favorite scene, blink and you'll miss it. During the climactic battle against Doomsday, she gets knocked to the ground and looks back at the monster and smiles. That motherfucker is Wonder Woman. Amazon warrior princess who knows a good battle when she's in one. They can explore other aspects of her character in her solo movie. But that moment for an action comic book movie was character perfection. Jesse Eisenberg also gave a fantastic performance. He even took it to an area I didn't expect. I mentioned Heath Ledger as the Joker a few moments ago. Whether he intended it or not, I think Eisenberg took some inspiration from that performance. Watch the scene in The Dark Knight with Joker and Batman in the interrogation room. Then watch the scene in Batman vs. Superman where Superman confronts Luthor on top of the LexCorp building. both times, the bad guy is confronted with a furious and stronger hero. Both times, you can tell the bad guy is more than a little scared and intimidated. But he still knows he has the upper hand, and his confidence grows in the scene until he tells the hero that the time for his loved one is running out. That's not to say it is in any way plagiarized. Rather, bravo to both performances and to the screenwriters. But my favorite scene, tough call, but I would have to go with the initial meeting at LexCorp with the senator and his argument for bringing the kryptonite into the United States. He always seems 2 seconds away from a homicidal rage. Some quick hits on the other characters. Alfred's snarkiness is always a good thing in any interpretation of the Batman. Jeremy Irons nailed it. Perry White felt more like a grizzled but strong leader of a new staff than any other live-action Superman I've seen. Lawrence Fishburne nailed it. The tragic arc of Wallace, the Bruce Wayne employee who loses his legs in the Man of Steel battle, and later becomes a pawn of Luthor to bring a bomb into the Senate hearing to kill everybody around Superman, is absolutely heartbreaking. We got a brief speaking role from the cinematic version of The Flash, and a good long look at Aquaman, and the origin of Cyborg merging with a mother box. I'm looking forward to all of them, and I can't wait to see how Flash's warning from the future plays out. A lot of people didn't like the introduction of these characters because they felt it lengthened the movie and disrupted the flow. I understand that to a certain extent. But I liked DC's attempt to work teasers for other films within the movie instead of sitting through an almost 10-minute list of movie credits for a tiny little payoff. I mean, really, I had to sit through all this shit just to see Thor's hammer? Thanks a lot. One of the staples of modern comic books is the planting of storyline seeds that don't come into play for months and sometimes years. Another way writers tease upcoming storylines is simply use a page or three to show panels from future issues. I'm okay with that, but I'd rather they use the pages for the story and work those teases into the story itself. That's probably why I prefer DC's inter-narration to Marvel's post-credits tease. But I know I'm probably in the minority on that. Martha Kent, I'll get to in a moment. Jonathan Kent's appearance in Superman's Dream was a brilliant, quiet scene that drove home the point of the movie for anybody who wasn't paying attention, which, from the way critics reviewed the movie, I think is probably about 70% of them. Wonderful scene, excellent story, good moral. Lastly, Lex's main henchman in the movie. In the comic books, he's known as KG Beast. Thankfully, not referenced in the movie. Okay, a few things I didn't like, in order from the minor things to the major things. Did Doomsday really need to have an additional power? The destructive energy discharge was not in the comic books, and he's so damn strong, he really didn't need any more power, even if he does have to take on both Superman and Wonder Woman. But within the story, it makes sense. See, one of the things the naysayers whined about most about Man of Steel is the massive destruction in populated areas. This time, Batman has managed to keep Doomsday in an abandoned area of the city. So if no one is there to witness it, how can they know how dangerous Doomsday is? But if he's seen letting off a few highly destructive, and more importantly, highly visible energy waves, then people will understand how serious the threat is. The movie opens with Batman's origins again. I've seen this about a dozen times in live action, animation, TV, and movies. I don't think there's anyone left who would go to a movie like this who doesn't know about Thomas and Martha Wayne murdered in front of a young Bruce who eventually becomes Batman. But I just recapped it in case there's somebody listening to this podcast who doesn't know. Plus, it was key in the turning point of the movie, and it ran during the opening credits, so at least it was quickly out of the way. Plus, it becomes clear this is Bruce Wayne's dream, which is one of three that he has in the movie. Although I do think the second dream, with the creature breaking out of the mother's grave, was definitely unnecessary. They didn't need to do the origin again, but I understand why they did it, so I may not like it, but it's not significant enough to alter my opinion of the movie. Batman brands a criminal with his bat symbol, and the news reports claim it would be considered a death sentence in prison. Why? If a bad guy has a scar of a vigilante who sides with the police, wouldn't that give him prison cred? When the titular confrontation begins, Superman tries to reason with Batman to get help saving Martha Kent, whom Luther kidnapped. He walks toward Batman and triggers a sonic trap. Superman gets out of the trap and then keeps walking toward Batman trying to talk to him. Dumbass, stay where you are and explain yourself. Instead, he triggers another trap and gives up and starts fighting. Yes, I know. If he acts rationally, Batman versus Superman becomes more like a high school debate rather than an action sequence. And I'm sure they were pressed enough for time, so they kind of forced the onset of the promised battle. That I can forgive. When the bomb goes off in the Senate hearing, I would like to have seen Superman realize what is happening just an instant too late and react a split second before the bomb goes off. Then, amidst the flames, I would have liked to see him react with anguish and anger instead of sorrow. But that inward reaction of missing the cause of so many deaths plays into the next scene with Lois. I'll roll with it, but I still think my way is better. When Batman gets in the car chase to go after the smuggled kryptonite, why does he bother to grapple and tow a car behind him? Pulling that kind of dead weight is sure to slow him down, and there is no way he could have known there would be a far-fetched opportunity a moment later to use the vehicle to flip in the air and land on some more of the bad guys. No, that was just dumb. But the biggest thing I didn't like about the movie, they killed off Mercy Graves. That sucked. Okay, a few quick theories. I think Lex, for sure, and Bruce, possibly, are subconsciously receiving messages from the new gods, and perhaps even being controlled to a small degree. Lex hates Superman anyway, so Darkseid could be manipulating Lex to do the dirty work of getting rid of Superman. Bruce is acting irrationally. Now, that could be because this interpretation is loosely based on the Batman from 1986's Dark Knight Returns, which is also the inspiration for the big battle between the two main characters. Even the emaciated Superman floating above the Earth after the nuclear blast was taken from that comic book. But manipulation from the fourth world, that would explain why Lex had several different levels of plans to take out Superman. From attacking his reputation to direct attacks on his life. It would also explain why Batman had become so fearful and brutal, an extra level on top of what he already seems to have experienced. Or, what if Lex is being influenced by Darkseid, while Batman is being influenced by Highfather or Orion? If you don't know who they are, Google it or contact me on Twitter. How does Superman come back from the dead? Well, in the comic books, when Superman was killed defeating Doomsday, he eventually is revived by the Genesis Chamber, the same place where Lex created Doomsday in the movie. But Lex is probably the only one who knows how to use it, and I doubt he would be willing to help. So, what about the cortex that Jor-El placed in his son before sending him to Earth in the Man of Steel movie? What if the biological makeup of the entire Kryptonian race can mend the damage? Grant Morrison has portrayed Superman as basically immortal in many of his comic book stories. This may be a good way to explain it for the movie continuity. But of course, this is primarily a sociopolitical podcast. So, even though I make the rules, I feel I probably should make a little bit of an effort to do so. Fortunately, the movie gave a few nuggets to mine. Now, please understand, while there are some storylines involving politicians, this is not at all a political movie. I'm taking these ideas put forth in the movie and refracting them through my political prism. I want to contrast what the politician has to say about Superman to what Martha Kent has to say about the son she raised. I find it interesting that the politician says she grew up on a farm, and obviously Martha Kent, in this continuity, at least married a farmer and became one for some time. They both come from the same roots, but their lives and knowledge have taken them to vastly different conclusions. The politician doesn't really know Superman. She knows of him. She's heard and seen some things. But personally, she has no idea who the man is. However, she purports to hold authority over him because she's a member of the government. The senator says, "The world has been so caught up with what Superman can do that no one has asked what he should do." And later, she alludes that in a democracy, a conversation must be had to decide what is right and good for Superman to do. That's what politicians do. They make judgments and legislation based on a little general information. This person testified that the village was destroyed after Superman showed up, therefore he must be responsible. Well, this person lost his legs, so Superman ought to come to my hearing to explain his actions. Then we'll talk about what this powerful being can and can't do. On the other hand, we have the mom. She knows Superman, probably better than anyone else, even Lois Lane. She loves her son. So as her son comes to her, amidst all the commentary and accusations of people who, like the politician, have limited knowledge of Superman, the mother pushes it all away. Be their hero, Clark. Be their angel. Be their monument. Be anything they need you to be. Or be none of it. You don't owe this world a thing. You never did. Now, I emphasize those words a little bit differently than the way she did in the movie, but that's because I needed to stress that point. See, another character had accused Superman of answering to no one, not even God. Mom basically enables that thought. But she can do that. Because she has the one bit of knowledge no one else has. She knows she can trust her son. She knows we can trust Superman. These are the kind of mindsets I've been going on about for the past 6 years now in these podcasts. The politician doesn't trust you. and wants you to conform to his or her version of morality somewhere along the narrow political spectrum between extreme neoconservatism and extreme modern liberalism. They don't care about trampling on your individual rights because they don't know you, the individual. They can only think of us as a collective. And they will sacrifice individual liberty for the will of the majority. And the majority is erroneously given the power to decide what is right and good. Our society has succumbed to the mindset that the majority, or a group with enough perceived power, has the right to demand how everyone else lives their life. But when you get down to the personal level, where you ignore the hearsay and the statistics, and you get to know the individuals, not even as closely as a mother to a child, but just a solid, basic knowledge, you realize that individuals can and ought to be trusted to live their lives and deal with the consequences of their decisions. Individuals can do amazing things and inspire others to do amazing things. But the individual is under no obligation to do so. Superman is his own agent, unanswerable to the government. The only people he has to answer to are the people he chooses to assist, those with whom he voluntarily interacts. Had the politician been able to bend Superman to the will of her majority, which dictates her version of morality, then he would no longer be Superman. He would be a tool of the government. A tool of power. A tool of force. I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast alternative versions of these superheroes. It's no surprise to me that whenever Superman is the agent of the government in these alternate stories, like The Dark Knight Returns or Red Sun, he's the villain. Why? Because government is force. Government, by nature, is a force of coercion. So when Superman is taken out of his American farm boy roots that values individual liberty and personal responsibility, and he becomes the tool of the collective, he loses that inspiration that makes him just a guy who wants to do good, and instead makes him the powerful being sanctioned by a powerful bureaucracy. The politician has a messiah complex, believing she can force Superman to conform to the tyranny of the majority. Lex Luthor has a messiah complex, believing he can force Superman to conform with the tyranny of fear. Superman, ironically the closest allegory to a messiah, doesn't want to be a messiah. He refuses to be controlled by others. He does not want to act out of fear. He just wants to do his best. But he has to do it as an individual, or else he knows he can't do it at all. And these days, as real-life politicians with real-life messiah complexes grow the real-life government more and more powerful to the point where so many people put faith in government like it is some kind of messiah, I'm reminded of the best line in the movie. I figured out way back, if God is all-powerful, he cannot be all-good. And if he is all-good, then he cannot be all-powerful. This is the Raging Rhino Podcast. You'll hear from me again.